Hi, Michael. How are you doing today?
I am very well, thank you.
Brilliant. So let's begin with the first question, which is around what is your experience when it comes to creativity? And I know that you used to be an actor back in the day before transitioning into personal development and being a speaker and writer and a lot of different things. So I'm curious to hear what's your relationship with creativity and how did it also evolve over time?
My relationship with, we're more than just good friends. We're quite intimate, creativity and I. For me, creativity is, I think of it as my relationship with God. It's my relationship with life, with source. So the source of creation, whatever you call that, I don't necessarily mean it in a way that other people mean it, but I have an image sometimes of you can enjoy being in a river, you can enjoy drinking from a river if the water's clean, and the closer to the source of the river you get, the fresher and purer the water. But if you go far enough upstream, there's like a waterfall in my imagination. And then if you climb to the top of the waterfall, there's a cave out of which the water is coming. So while depending on what I'm up to, I may be anywhere on the river, I'm always looking to the cave. I want to see what's coming fresh. I'm not so much interested in what's already been created. I'm interested in what wants to come out now. And that makes it endlessly fun. Like it at no point does it become boring. At no point does it be, now, not everything that comes is great. Right, people say I'm very, I've done a dozen books, I've done this, I've done that. I'm prolific. Half of what I do, nobody's ever going to see because it's crap. Like I, as best I can, only share the good stuff. But I live in the river. It's.
I love that analogy. And also, it relates to what we are doing with Magnetic Business. We're working with business owners who are falling out of love with their work. And they have done the thing and they have enjoyed to some extent. And at some point, they reach the ceiling where they're like, oh my God, I keep on recreating the same thing. I keep on hitting the same walls. And it's such a beautiful analogy to look into, like, okay, so where at the river are you? Are you looking up the stream or are you just focused on the dirty water somewhere down the stream? And it's such an invitation to realign with what it is that you are creating, whether you're an artist or a business owner or a teacher, whoever you are, how can you fall in love with your craft over and over and over again?
I'm equally curious how one falls out of love with one's craft. Because to me, the only way that you fall out of love with your craft is when it starts becoming too purposeful. When it starts becoming about the results. Now, of course it's about the results, especially in business. Nobody's pretending it isn't. But if it's too much about the results, you've lost touch with what actually created the business in the first place, with what actually created whatever it is that you do. I was just telling a story to a client earlier today about a man I knew who ran an aerospace company. So they had thousands of employees, billions of dollars in turnover, huge, huge company. But he had a really deep understanding of the mind and how the mind works. And so at one point he was told by the big boss, the chairman, it was the end of the first quarter and they'd been given a target of like $1 billion in revenue and for the year. And he hadn't turned any numbers in. And so the boss calls him and goes, hey, where are the numbers for the first quarter? And he goes, oh, we haven't done them yet. And the boss says, that's not good enough. You need to get the numbers. I don't care if you have to work all night. I want those numbers on my desk and you in my office tomorrow morning, 8 a.m. So he and the CFO stay up all night. They run the numbers. They show up. Well, in the first quarter, they'd already done over $1 billion in revenue. They'd already hit the year's target in the first quarter. And so the chairman, who was like all set to yell at him, was like, ah, well, this is very good. But next time, I want these numbers on my desk when they're supposed to be. And Don, the guy said, he said, no, sir, I'm not going to do that. And the chairman said, why not? And he said, because if we're paying attention to the numbers, we're not paying attention to what we're doing. We're not paying attention to what's allowing us to create those numbers. If my people are paying too much attention to targets, they're not paying attention to their job. I want my people to be engaged. I don't want them chasing some imaginary thing. So I'm pretty sure you like the results that are coming from that. So let us keep creating the results and yeah, you'll get the numbers. I mean, obviously it's still a business. They're still accountable. There's all that. And he said by the end, by the time he retired, he only ran the numbers twice a year before the semi-annual shareholders meetings. And that was when they did the numbers.
That's such a great point. And it also reminds me of my own journey when, well, in my case, how I fell out of love is simply because I went off track where I started working with not the right people, or let's put it this way, I wasn't in full alignment with what I really wanted. So then it was easy to fall out of love simply because I was like, oh, well, I am a new version of myself today compared to who I was a year ago or 2 years ago or 3 years ago. And yet not much changed in the meantime. And I was focusing still on the same thing, on the same goals. So for me, the learning was to slow down and evaluate and reevaluate and really reconnect with, okay, what is the passion? Where is that creativity coming from? What is the alignment? What does ignite me? What does excite me? Who are the people that I want to work with and how I want to run my business and so on? And I think that's what a lot of people don't do, where they don't reevaluate and they don't have these honest conversations with themselves of, okay, am I doing something that is in full alignment with what I want and where I'm heading? Or am I just on autopilot?
And well, so, okay, there's a basic business principle most people would agree with, even if they've never heard it like this, which is do more of what works. But the way that we interpret that as a rule is, if this particular offering works, offer it more. If this particular sales strategy works, do more of it. But we misunderstand. We think what worked was the form. What actually works is the love you have for the form. It's the passion you have. It's the curiosity about it. It's the engagement with. That's what works. And so we have to continually in our business check and see, and we have a sort of an arbitrary scale from 1 to 10 of how enthusiastic are we about anything that we're doing. Not in a fake, you can raw yourself up, but genuinely, like how excited am I about working on it? And if it's not an 8, 9, or 10, then we either have to find a way to get it back to an 8, 9, or 10 or let it go for now. Because what works is 8, 9, and 10. And so there are programs that we've run every year because we keep finding ways to be at an 8, 9, or 10. I remember the biggest program I ran in the 2010s was called Super Coach Academy. And it accounted for at one point more than half of my business's revenue, that one program. Well, in 2015, I didn't have the passion for it. I knew I needed a break. Our financial planner actually almost cried. Like, she was like, you can't stop. You can get somebody else to run it. You can do and I understood, like, I had thoughts like that too. And it was my wife who actually said to the financial planner, you know, Susan, Mikey, she calls me Mikey. You know, when Mikey knows something, just it'll work out. And I was like, cool, because I didn't even know that. Like, she saw it. I didn't. I was insecure as hell. But I just knew I had to not do it that year. And other things showed up that took care of and in fact exceeded the income of that. And then in the next year, we were back. We did it again because I re-engaged with it in a new way. So it does matter. But there's a lot of ways to get there. There's a lot of forms creativity can take. You're not stuck with whatever you did last time.
Mm-hmm. That's one side of the coin. And then the other side is what happens when you are in a stream of creativity and a new stream comes in. Mm-hmm. And both are maybe at an 8, 9, 10. How do you navigate that?
Well, as best I can, right? Sometimes by not sleeping, exhausting myself, getting ill, and having to start again. I don't recommend that, but you know, as best I can. When it does work, because often it does. See, for me, I'm a big believer that we know, that we have a knowing in us. And sometimes it's just a knowing. It's just a yes, no. It's not, there's no reasons. I have a rule of thumb I wrote about in one of my books that the number of reasons you have to do something is inversely proportional to how much you actually want to do it. Because if you really want to do something, you don't need a reason. And if you don't really want to do something, you need reasons. Right? So for me, one of the things is I've learned to trust that mostly, to listen for it, that knowing. And sometimes it's just a yes, no, and sometimes it's I really want to. And that's as good a guiding force as I have found in the universe, is knowing and desire. Like simple desire, not like I want it because it'll lead to this and that'll take me here. And it, no, not that. Just like I want a cup of tea. Right? That kind of desire. Like, it's like, I just want a cup of tea. Why? Because I want a cup of tea. I don't know. Like, it's that you can trust. And then there's just a knowing. So often that is enough to navigate those multiple streams. Because things are, I don't know if you guys feel this, but some ideas are not ripe yet. Some are overripe and some are falling off the tree into my hand. Like as best I can, I try to go with the ones that are ripe. And if I get excited about a second one, usually it's not ripe yet anyways. So it would be too soon to throw my eggs into that basket. I know it's there, I'm aware of it. And at some point, and in my, you know, I've been in business over 30 years. So I know, you know what, if it shows up in 3 years, that's still okay. It doesn't have to be in the next 10 minutes. I think so much business advice in the sphere of conscious business and small business is what can I do in the next 2 days? And it's like, look, if you're going to be in business for a while, that's a good thing. Like there'll be, I remember at one point we did some research and found out that most people who hired me had known about me for at least 18 months. So that took a lot of the, no, not always, some people just show up, but that took a lot of the pressure off to make a sale and convert somebody into a client. It's like, if you're not going to hire me for 18 months on average anyways, I can just talk to you. I can just be with you. I can just be myself with you. And then when you're ready, we'll find each other again. And if you're in this short-term mentality of I need now, it's hard to allow life to give you everything that's on offer.
It sounds like a very well-built boat in the stream that doesn't just get knocked over by every incoming wave, but you know, like there is this authority and there is this calmness and the patience that is looking now not back at the cave, but at the whole journey ahead.
Yeah. It's a nice, yeah. It is because like, I'm not, see, if you love what you do, you're not trying to get it over with, right? I meet people who are like, you know, what's your goal for your business? To sell it. And that's okay. Like, I understand that. And I've met people who are very successful doing it that way. But the ones who are successful aren't trying to sell it because they hate it. They're trying to sell it because that's what's exciting to them, is building something that people want to buy. So that works. That's fine. But if you are in business to get out of business, like you're trying to sell your way out, like, boy, if I just make enough money, then I don't have to do this crap anymore. Well, then you're in the wrong business. I can't help you, really, because, you know, I'm just going to help you be miserable longer. It's really hard to let go of something that's working financially for most people, even if they hate it. So in a way, you're better off getting out now when it's not working than waiting till it's successful and then trying to get out.
Absolutely. And then evaluating what's more important, to have a financially successful business or a business that is exciting to you and you feel absolutely in love with, and you wake up in the morning excited to to change the world, to change people's lives, to create something beautiful, to create something valuable that adds value to people, to the world, and makes the world a better place. And when
the problem with that question is at least 50% would say the one that makes money. Right? Because we have this myth that money is what makes everything okay. Now, look, I'm a fan of money. I'm absolutely not anti-money, but I can tell you it doesn't make everything okay. It oils the wheels a little bit. It makes everything less squeaky. But that's what it does. It's a really helpful tool. But if you start chasing it because you think that's what's going to make you happy and content and all the stuff that we associate culturally with money, you are going to choose the business that makes money on paper over the business that actually you love.
Until you realize that it doesn't bring you
right, which is why I have so many clients in their 40s and 50s who get to a point where they go, what the hell have I been doing for the last 20, 30 years?
Exactly.
And I mean, I can say from my own experience, and I would love to hear your feedback on it too, that there is a reality beyond the myth, that, you know, like it's difficult to let the myth go and believe that if I do what I love, I can be as or more successful. Like this is something a lot of people can't believe until they actually take that risk, they actually take that leap. And I feel like the role of a lot of people in the world today is to become that beacon of inspiration, to show that doing what I love, I can actually thrive, and you can too. Like that exists. So the way I see it is, you know, each of us has a piece of the puzzle that we are here to bring into the world. And there is a way to make that work, where because there is an abundance and an infinite amount of resources. So it's like if we figure out a way how to make our piece of the puzzle work instead of trying to just take the piece that was given to us saying that only this will work. I feel like it's about getting out of that mindset and honoring that your gift and your purpose, it can also thrive in this world.
So I've never thought of it quite the way I'm about to say it, but when you said that, what came to mind immediately is the reason that do what you love doesn't work for a lot of people is because they think what they love is the form. So I want to be, I mean, I used to be an actor. So a lot of I want to be an actor, but I can't be an actor unless people hire me. So, and it becomes this whole thing. I can't do what I love unless other people allow me to. What you love is the feeling of being creatively engaged. That's what everybody loves. It's not actually the form in which you experience that most often. So that's one thing that opens it up. But the other is, I think it's more helpful to love what you do than do what you love. I've seen a lot of people kill their love for things by trying to make it their job, right? Like I meet a lot of people who love singing until they try to become singers. They love helping people until they try to become professional helpers. And that turning it into a business sometimes kills that, because you have to do, you do have to do things to be successful that aren't what you would do if it was just your hobby that you loved. So it's an interesting thing. Like I said, I've never thought about it quite like that, but I wouldn't say do what you love to most people, because unless I had a chance to qualify it and say, and what you love is being creatively engaged. Do that.
What I would love to learn is, how did you, in your specific case, not let that be the issue or obstacle, where you did what you loved and you turned it into a business, but it didn't become this heavy thing and it didn't become something that you no longer love. So what happened in your case?
I'm actually a great example, because I did both at the same time. I had two lives, and I just had them backwards in my head until I didn't. So I went to drama school in London, trained as a, and was fairly successful. I had a sitcom in the UK. I did a ton of radio. I was, you know, I was a working successful actor over there. But I'd lost interest about 10 years before I stopped. I didn't know I'd lost interest because I was doing it, and that's who I was, and that's what I did. And so I had this hobby, which is that I loved coaching people and self-help and spiritual spelunking, as my friend and I used to call it, and teaching. And so that was just my hobby. That was just what I did for fun. And everything in that arena of my life flowed. Like people found me, people hired me. I remember one place I went where they said, well, you have to work for us for 2 years before we will put you in front of a group. And they put me in front of a group that weekend. Like it was just, and in my acting career, I worked my ass off. I was successful because I worked hard and I developed a thick skin and I pushed. But this other thing that was just what I kind of enjoyed doing, I didn't do shit. I mean, honestly, I just kind of showed up and did my thing. And then one day, and it was, I mean, I actually wrote about it in my first book because it was the moment that I got it. So it was 2005 and I was in Chicago performing at a comedy festival, doing sketch comedy. So in America, there's a show called Saturday Night Live, and it's the ultimate sketch. And that was my dream job, was to be on Saturday Night Live. And the feeder companies for Saturday Night Live are Groundlings and Second City. So they're these two comedy companies where most people who've been on SNL were in one or the other. So I'm in Chicago, and two things happened. One night, I got in a cab around midnight after the show, and it started to snow. And I grew up in New England where it snowed, but I now live in California where it doesn't. And so I got really excited. I was like, oh, it's snowing. And the cab driver slammed on the brakes, just turned around and glared at me. I'm like, oh God, what have I done? And he just started talking. And his name was Adolf, and he was from Ghana. And he just told me about his whole life. And we wound up spending a couple hours. He pulled the cab over, you know, turned off the meter. You know, and snow's piling up outside the cab, and we're just talking through the mirror, through the rearview mirror. He never even turned around. And we talked about life, and I remember thinking, oh, I'm wondering if this is why I'm in Chicago, because the show didn't go great. Like the show was okay, but like this was an amazing conversation we were having. And I remember thinking, this was 2005, so he didn't have internet. Like this, it's hard to remember back to when people, but like, cause I wanted to send him some stuff and he was like, and I thought, oh man, I wish I had a book. Like that was in my head. And the next day, so that happened. The next day I go in and Second City saw my show and wanted me to join them. And my first thought was, I want to go home. So this pathway to my dream job, as I had thought about it for decades, was on offer. And my first thought was, I want to go home. And my second thought was, oh, I'm done. And so then I went, oh, well, maybe I'll write that book. And a year later, my first book came out, became a number one bestseller in the UK, and my career took off. But I'd been doing it for 15, 20 years, just not as a career. So by the time I decided that was what I was going to do, I was so steeped in it that it wasn't starting from scratch at all. It was just, I hadn't thought of it as my job until I did.
So what's your relationship with the beyond? Let's just call it that. It sounds like, you know, things are happening which are not just coincidental. Like there is something, like you said, you know, maybe this is what was meant to happen in Chicago. There is something that has a more than material impact in your life. So what's your relationship to that which is beyond?
So it seems to me, and that's really all I can say, is that we're made of the formless presence of life. All things are made of the formless presence of life, including us. And so within that, there's what I would call the divine unfolding. Now, I don't know what that means. If you try to pin me down, I'll get squirmy. Does that mean it's all preordained or some of it's preordained? I don't know. But I notice that when I allow it to, things unfold as if by design. Like, couldn't have been more perfect the way they happen. I don't know what that is, but I know it is. And I've seen it with so many people, not just me. Like my first book, the one I told you about, it wound up being published by Hay House as You Can Have What You Want. But when I wrote it, the title was Soul Path. Because what I'd noticed is that the people I worked with who were really happy and successful, so there were plenty of people who were successful and miserable, fair degree of people who were happy and unsuccessful, but the ones who were both, the way they did life was just different to how I'd been taught. They just seemed to be themselves and do what they occurred to them to do. And it was like their soul was laying the path out in front of them one step at a time. And so that's what I noticed. That's what I saw. That's what I experienced. And that's what I continue to notice and see and experience, that when we are willing to show up and be ourselves, life unfolds in ways we couldn't possibly have designed or predicted. Now, you have to show up, right? It doesn't work if you don't show up. And you can't know seven steps ahead because they haven't happened yet. So there's this kind of sweet, I may as well be present because I don't know what's going to happen. So I may as well be here. And so my relationship with that beyond is, to me, it is what I am made of. And so when I allow it to unfold, it's perfect for me. When you allow it to unfold, it's perfect for you. I've followed for many years a spiritual teacher named Sid Banks, a Scottish mystic. He's passed in like 2011, I think, or 2009 even. I never actually met him, but I came across him around that time. And through his books and his teachings, it did a lot for me. And one of the things that he would talk about was that, you know, all things are made of the same thing. Everything comes from nothing. The formless and the form, that's how it works. Formless becomes form. That's creativity, is we're taking this divine nothingness and creating tangible things, something from no thing. And that's the game of life. And we human beings are this perfect nexus where where humanity and divinity collide. Like there's a big bang going on in here every day, and new shit's getting created in the world. Now, to me, that's where I want to live. That's where I love to be, is at that point. Like, I remember when I was in the early 90s, I went to Hawaii. It was actually 1990, to do a Tony Robbins course. And I met up with this group of Australians who had a real sense of adventure. And I was probably, I don't know, I was in my early 20s at most. I might not have been mid 20 yet. And they were like, hey, come on, we're going to go see the volcano. The volcano was active at that time on the Big Island. And so we got up at like 3 a.m. and they're like, okay, you're driving, because we don't know how to drive on this side of the road. And I'm like, ah. So I'm driving in the middle of nowhere. We can see the red in the distance. So we're just kind of heading towards the red, and we get to the point where the road stops and we hike out. It turns out this was all illegal. I didn't know it at the time. But we hiked out to a point where there was literally a river of lava flowing over a cliff into the ocean. And we sat and we watched as the sun rose. So there's a waterfall of lava hitting the waves of the ocean, crashing into the cliff, pillars of smoke rising. It was the most biblical thing I have ever been a part of. But that for me has always been my metaphor for creativity. Like, that's the point where the magic happens. And if you want the magic to happen, you kind of have to hang out at that point.
And that's a huge challenge. Like, this is exactly how I feel about, you know, what I call super conscious, is whether the human and the divine meet. where you're not being too human and you're not being too divine, you're not being too materialistic and you're not being too spiritual, you're in this perfect balance. And it's so delicate and so it is a challenge to stay there, because each wants to pull you in one direction. You know, it's sometimes you just want to be passive and like, oh wow, it's beautiful. And sometimes you want to be overactive and get the results. And like, where is that fine line? So how do you navigate that? Like, how do you stay in that middle?
Well, so there's two things I find helpful. One is, metaphorically, I think of that place as the butterfly point, I call it, where if you were holding a live butterfly in your hand, you couldn't just leave your hand open because it would fly away, but you can't hold on tight because you'll kill the butterfly. So you have to find that point where you can feel the butterfly's wings fluttering in your hand. So part of it is just a feel you get for it. And it's that one of the chapters in my first book was called The Secret of Letting Go for It, because it's kind of that. You kind of have to let go, but you kind of have to be involved. So that's how I experience it. But how I actually, what I've learned does it, that's much easier, is just be yourself. And being yourself is already in balance. You already are that balance. So how do you be yourself would be the next question people often ask. Fortunately, all you have to do to be yourself is stop trying to be somebody else. Right? It sounds crazy, but it really is that simple. Most of us spend a lot of time trying to be somebody. Like, I want to, in a way, you could make a difference between the self-image and the self. Right? So I want to be the kind of person who, I don't want to be the kind of person who, I want people to see me as this, I don't want them to see me as that, I want to see myself this way, I don't want to, all of that is what gets in the way of just being yourself. It turns out, so another thing Sid talked about is he when he talked about ego, he would just say, ego is just your image of self. It's your image of self importance. He said, if you drop ego, what's left is actually nicer. It's really nice. That's my experience. It's just who we actually are when we're not trying to be somebody is really nice and already is that butterfly point. So it's less something I have to do, though that's how it started for me totally, was trying to hold the butterfly, and more just a way of being in the world.
It's especially powerful to hear these words from an actor, from someone whose profession was to be someone else.
You know, I never actually thought about that, but you're right. That's part of life's little irony.
And I think, like, what I have noticed in actors, which is that in being everyone else, is like, you know, you do find something within you which remains static, which, like, there is that underlying thread which is always present, and that is the you, which I have felt in some actors which are at their peak. Like, they can go so into the role, but there is that essence of them which you can always feel. And you say it is simple, and I do love to differentiate simple from easy, because for a lot of people, simple is not easy. Simple can be the most difficult thing, because, like, what you're talking about is a very intimate relationship with yourself, knowing yourself that deeply and going out of all the stories that you have been conditioned with. And, you know, it's the way we live, and all the work we have done on ourselves is to reach that point where we know ourselves and we know what the story is, and to keep shedding that story and keep coming back to that raw, pure essence. I'm curious about your journey, like, what brought you to the point, and, like, you know, what was the challenge you faced in shedding those stories, like, or did it just happen magically?
Well, so I'll go with you on simple isn't always easy. But what simple is a point on the compass you can follow. if it doesn't seem simple, you know you're overthinking it somehow. You know you're in a story. So simple is actually a really helpful directional tool. Because when it's simple, it's of the soul. When it's complicated, it's of the mind or the ego. So for me, I mean, and honestly, I've been all over the shop. I mean, I do think of human beings as lovable messes, right? And I include myself in that, right? like, boy, have I tried hard over the years to get it right and to be the right thing and to do the right thing. And I got so much compassion for that guy. But I'm also glad that he's mostly gone to sleep and I woke up. Because it was tiring being him, right? So for me, how do the stories go? Well, the stories go. One of my favorite descriptions of the state of meditation. It's not the practice necessarily, because there's a million practices, but the place that you get to in a practice, the space before thought. I talk about it in my work as the space within, the space inside which thought comes and goes. That space, living in that space, they call in some Eastern traditions, the great undoing. Because what happens in that space is all of the stories of the self start to unravel. It just starts falling apart. It's like taking ice and putting it out in the sun. It melts. You can go with a chisel and try and chisel away this story and chisel away that story, but ultimately it can't survive sunlight. And sunlight is consciousness. So the more time you spend resting in consciousness in that space, the more the stories fall away. So yeah, did I spend years trying to get rid of them? Sure. But the guy who was trying to get rid of them was a product of them, right? That was part of the story, was trying to get rid of the stories. And it wasn't...
That identification is very strong. So, you know, like that's the spiritual journey is breaking that identification and coming into your true or real identity. And that switch, I think, is the crucial part where you, the one who's trying to survive, you let it die in a sense. You let it go to sleep. You put it more subtly, but it's like coming into that real identity can be very scary, because so much of our self-worth is tied to the image we have created about ourselves, especially when you go into higher levels of, you know, worldly success. So if you have made that switch before, I feel like it's easier in a way, because you can detach from the success and you always know yourself beyond that success. But I feel like, you know, once that identity hardens with success, it becomes a lot more challenging to let it go and switch into that true identity. So what would be your, what would you say to that?
Well, this is going to sound strange, but I would say thinking about it that way makes it sound hard, so I wouldn't think about it that way. Like there's a great anecdote that I think is true about a hypnotherapist in the 1950s named Dr. J. Haley, and he was one of the first people who made clinical hypnotherapy a legitimate psychological profession. And he was giving a lecture. And he was asked, at the time, schizophrenia was a brand new diagnosis. It hadn't existed as a diagnosis before. And at that time, they didn't understand enough about it to have a treatment plan, but it was recognized. And somebody asked him, well, how would you use clinical hypnotherapy in a case of schizophrenia? And he said, well, schizophrenia is that new diagnostic that at the moment there's no known cure for, right? And they said, yes. And he said, well, why would I ever diagnose a patient with a disease I didn't know how to cure? Mm-hmm. Like, we're just interpreting data. So it's not helpful to interpret it in ways that make it seem hard or scary or daunting. Now, it is observable that at times I struggle to be myself, that at times people struggle to let go of their story and of their ego. Yeah, no questions about that. But for me, there's two things that I see that make it not seem so hard. One is, if I have an understanding of how thought works, generally, that we live in these thought-created worlds, but they're not real, they can change in a heartbeat, then part of that thought-created world is who I think I am. So it's no different to any other thought. So it's not like, oh yeah, but this thought. No, it's all the same thing. So if I see through thought anywhere, I can see through thought anywhere. The other half is, I find that when I talk to people about true nature, because as best I can, I'm talking about it from true nature, it's like a tuning fork. And that which I am at least in that moment awake to in me is wakes up in them, and they know what I'm talking about. And so then it just becomes about strengthening it. Once somebody has a taste of it, and they can, and especially if they can see through at least a little bit thought, then it just gets stronger and stronger. So in Dzogchen Buddhism, the way it was taught to me, the idea is that you want to have a taste, the one taste, as soon as early as possible in your practice. And then the rest of practice is just about increasing the duration, the purity, and the depth. That for me is a metaphor for how I look at it, is I want somebody to touch this as quickly as we can get there. And then everything we do for the rest of our lives together is just about increasing that depth and purity and duration of the experience. And that's, I'm not saying that that's easy, but it's not hard. It's just, it is what it is.
Does that make sense? It does make sense. And I love that perspective, that it doesn't, like, it's only our minds that make things seem complicated. And that in itself makes things complicated. Huh. So why are we overcomplicating everything? And I always am a big advocate of simplicity and really dismantling everything that doesn't have to be as complicated as we create it. And throughout the conversation, we were talking about also knowingness and listening and intuition and true nature and all of that. And so I wonder, how do you on a daily basis practically reconnect, or maybe you don't even have to reconnect because you're always connected to that true nature and the true version of you? What is your daily life looking like when it comes to embodying the true Michael?
Well, it's been a journey. I had the deepest experience that I had of this for many years was in 1999. And I had an experience that went on for about 6 weeks of just totally living like this. And I kind of knew I'd found the secret, but I didn't know what it was. Right. So people would ask me, what's going on with you? And I was like, well, just be happy. And they're like, yeah, that's not doing it for me. And I'm like, okay, well, be happy and do what you want. it was utterly unhelpful, but I didn't know how, I couldn't explain it. I was just, it was so new to me. And then a year and a half later, I woke up again, and I hadn't been there for a year and a half, but I hadn't noticed. And then I started going, oh, okay, well, I need to find a practice so that I don't forget. But of course, that didn't take, because that wasn't it. And I've known for years that that was the most important thing. But I haven't, I still thought it was outside me. It was a little different to me. One of my books is called The Space Within. I'm just going to read you the back cover. There's a space within you where you are already perfect, whole, and complete. It is a space of pure consciousness, the space inside which all thoughts come and go. When you rest in the feeling of this space, the warmth of it heals your mind and body. When you operate from the infinite creative potential of this space, you produce high levels of performance and creative flow. When you sit in the openness of this space with others, you experience a level of connection and intimacy that is breathtakingly enjoyable and filled with love. And when you explore this space more deeply, you will find yourself growing closer and closer to the divine, even if you're not sure there is such a thing and wouldn't know how to talk about it if there was. Every problem we have in life is the result of losing our bearings and getting caught up in the content of our own thinking. The solution to every one of those problems is to find our way back home. One problem, one solution, infinite possibilities.
Wow.
Now that's how I saw it until about a year ago. And all that changed is I realized, oh, it's not a space within me, it's me. That is me. And once that shift happened, and I couldn't fake it, but I can't unfake it either. Once I saw, oh shit, that's me. Well, yeah, of course I'm there most of the time because it's me.
That's so powerful. And I have so many things to say about that, but I feel like one of the important things you said, you know, is like the transmission that takes place when you're in the field of someone who is there already, like is one of the most powerful awakenings. Like all you have to do is be, and it's as simple as that. Like the other person will eventually get a taste of that if they open to receive. And a lot of everything that comes after that becomes this identity of the practitioner, which then becomes another thing which you get caught up in. It's like, I have to practice to stay in this, and I have to hold on to it because it's so precious. And in that, you just end up losing it because
I did it for decades.
This has been, I think, for everyone who finally wakes up from the practitioner identity, it is the most important realization, is that the more you try to hold on to it, the lesser you have it. And it's just there, and you don't need to do anything to work for it or have it. It's there. Like, and if you do get caught up in the stream, it's fine. Like, that's also life, and that's also part of the game. Like, you know, don't fight that, because that is, again, not actually helping you to come out of it. So wake up in the game rather than trying to come back to something which is you know, like an idea. Basically, it's just an idea of what it is supposed to be and how it is supposed to feel. But if you wake up in every single moment and realize, oh, I'm actually here, whatever is happening, I'm already here.
Even and, if it's some kind of a challenge that you're going through.
Yeah, like,
and often people wake up inside the challenge. I mean, that's one of the few, you know, when I talk to practitioners about it, like coaches mostly in my world, you know, I talk about it as good news that sounds like bad news.
Yeah.
It sounds like bad news to say, hey, as you wake up more in yourself, you will have more impact on everyone without doing anything. But you can't fake it. It's like, that's terrible news because I'm not and I want it. But actually, once you start to, it's great news because there's nothing you got to do. So it is an interesting paradox.
Yeah. And I think this is the thing that the ego loves the most, is, you know, keeping the idea alive that I have to do something. And like, it's I think the last thing that gets dropped by the ego is that I don't have to do something.
Well, so for me, what actually led to that shift that I described was seeing that I had misunderstood the ego. So I have always thought that ego equals arrogance. Because that's another way we use that word. So dropping the ego is, yeah, I should be less arrogant. Yeah, no, I'm terribly. And anything that smack, oh, I can't promote myself. That would be arrogant. Or you know, and people who've seen my stuff over the years would laugh because I do promote myself. But believe me, if I wasn't scared of being arrogant, it would have been much louder. So I thought, well, there's nothing more arrogant than thinking you're God. Like not God, but like the thinking you're this, like that's the most arrogant thing in the world. So no, I can't go there. But if ego is our image of self, well, then that's just another attempt to preserve an image of myself as, oh, I'm so humble, I don't think I'm great. Like that's bullshit too. So for me, when I really saw that, and you again, you can't fake an insight, but when you've got one, you know it, when you just see it, it was like, oh. And I remember literally where I was. I was in an airport in Portland, Oregon, and I just suddenly saw, holy shit, I'm this. And I remember like was scribbling in a notebook, and I looked back on it and it's worthless because all it said was I, me, mine. Like it just sounded like this outpouring of ego, but actually it was the first time where it wasn't, because it was not anybody. It was just all of us. We're all this. And yeah, in me, it's Michael flavored, right? In you, it's Ruta flavored, it's Teo flavored, but it's the same thing. And it's just seasoned by our personalities and life experiences. And that's gorgeous.
I think it's one of the biggest misinterpretations in spirituality is that the ego is, like the way it's demonized, it's sad for me, because now, like I've had that similar awakening where I just started realizing that the ego is divine, and creating the separation and saying the ego is
the bad guy.
Bad. Like you're already separating and you're not in that oneness. You're not in that wholeness where you realize that that is part of the fabric of reality. And it's who you are. And it's just that identity that you used to navigate reality and life and this world, and that's beautiful. If you can own that in a healthy way and see that this is beautiful, this is my beauty, it's my self-image of yourself, it's where the, I feel like that's the final awakening, is seeing that the ego is as divine as anything.
Well, and I guess, you know, it just looks a little different to me. For me, it doesn't have a life of its own. There is no thing like I'll show you my water can. Show me your ego. Like you can't. It's a thought. It's a concept. And as a concept, it will come and go. It can't have permanence, no matter how hard we try to make it permanent. So, to try and fight your ego is like trying to fight the wind. You're going to lose, but only always. There's a lovely line in A Course in Miracles where it says, nothing real can be threatened. Nothing unreal exists. Herein lies the peace of God. Well, real and unreal, when it's talked about in spiritual teachings, usually means constant versus variable, permanent versus temporary. So anything made of thought is temporary. So nothing real, and who you are is real, can be threatened. Nothing unreal, including the ego, exists. Therein lies the peace of God. And so that's, you know, I would preface everything I say for all time with, it seems to me, because that's all I've got, but that's how it seems to me.
Beautiful.
Yeah, I feel like that's a perfect place to close.
Absolutely beautiful. And thank you so much for all of your insights and wisdom, and just feeling your presence and how really true you are to yourself, to the world, to the universe is really beautiful to see and witness and experience. So thank you so much for being here.
A pleasure. It's nice to spend some time with you guys in such a beautiful place.